Hello and welcome along to the Property Academy podcast by Urbis Partners. I'm your host, Stephen Knight.
And I'm Andrew Nicol.
And to the show, we've got another Case Study Sunday, and we are so pleased to be joined by Dave, who joins us from Hamilton. Dave, welcome along to the show.
Howdy, good to be here.
Now, Dave, you've been listening to the show for probably about 8 months now, but you've got a pretty cool investment portfolio that you've been growing, done really well for 38 years old. Tell us, how did you get started in investing?
So I was in an owner-occupier that I bought back in 2012. And basically, the long story short is growth in equity and the passing of my father and gaining some inheritance unlocked the ability to do something more. So the next step was in 2019, me and my partner at the time purchased the house that I'm in now. And it was quite a step up, but because of the position I was in, I was able to do that. Thankfully, I was able to turn the owner-occupied into my first investment property.
That's great. Now, you said partner at the time. That makes me think that might not be your partner now. Is that the case?
That is the case, yes, yes.
And what happened?
Basically, we just went different directions in life, and unfortunately, yeah, just that part fell apart. It wasn't my first separation while having assets, and so we sort of went through the process, and I did have some things in place, but I was fortunate enough to have a bit of a battle with the bank and get them to help me to pay her out her equity in the house. I think one of the biggest things at that point was I only got this house that I'm in now because of her income. I'm self-employed and I had started my business and I was 5 years ago now. So there was a bit of a struggle to get that over the bank to get them to help me through that period.
So that's something that people don't think about. If you separate and you have to buy out your partner and you think, okay, well, I'll just borrow that money from the bank. If your mortgage requires two incomes, or in this case, you potentially were able to actually service the mortgage that you're asking for, but you weren't able to necessarily prove that to the bank because the bank requires 2 years worth of business financials that then they're going to average it out. So how did you get around that in the end?
My grandfather has a bit of advice and he says, knock on the front door and if no one's home, knock on the back door. And if no one's home there, you knock on the window. So pretty much I just kept going back to the bank saying, look, I don't understand your jargon. I don't understand the things. I'm already covering all of the mortgage, all of the bills. My income hasn't changed. Everything's in place. They were basically saying to me that policies changed from Australia and therefore we have new criteria need to meet. And I was saying, well, nothing's changed on my end. So give me a tangible of what I need to work with and I'll achieve that. And we basically just worked through the process until they had nothing. They could have always just said no, but I was just persistent, I guess, is the main thing. Yeah.
Really had to knock on the window now. And tell us, where have you grown your portfolio to? How many properties you got now, Dave?
So I own 4 properties. The house I'm in now I own occupied, and I have 3 rentals. One of them is an existing, my first one, and since then I've bought 2 turnkey duplexes.
That's awesome that you've been able to grow to 4 properties in total at just 38 years old. I mean, how many properties would the average 38-year-old own?
Oh, well, if I just look around my own friend circles, one maybe. Some people are lucky if they've got a rental and, you know, a lot of my friends are still renting, which is perfectly fine, especially where things are at the moment. You know, I'm just very fortunate and have done a bit of work where I needed to, you know.
And the interesting thing is that you don't just wake up one morning and own 3 rental properties. You've got to go out there and purchase the first one and then eventually you've got to decide, oh, I'm going to go and buy another one. And it actually does take a bit of work, a bit of motivation to go and make it happen. So what has led you to buy your first one and then continue to grow to your second and then continue to grow your third? What's kept you going?
So the main thing at the start was, like I say, my father passed away and I got a little bit of inheritance. It wasn't massive, but it was pretty big. So about 300K. And all of that was pretty much his life insurance. That was all his left. He didn't have a house when he passed or anything like that. But luckily he left me that stuff and I'm very grateful. So I always sort of looked at it like, you know, you could go out and do a million different things. And the one thing I didn't want to do is go out and spend it or put it into something that meant that if I did a venture in life, say my business that I have, and something went wrong, then all of a sudden I've left nothing to my son. So I always tried to look at that like it's not really my money. And how can I grow that to leave something to my son and therefore my grandkids, you know? That's been my driver in the background. And now that I'm in the position that I'm in now I'm like, well, it is all me and I need to maintain it and I need to do everything yeah, just in honor of my father rather than in his place. Yeah.
It's really interesting that you said your dad had life insurance, but he didn't own a house. So normally people get life insurance because they've either got young kids or a mortgage. I'm guessing your dad was relatively old, and so it would have been quite expensive. What was his motivation for having that insurance? Do you know? Did you ever have that conversation?
Lots of conversations we did have and lots of conversations we didn't have, but I would say that he just did life a little bit differently in some areas. He didn't have a house for various different reasons at the time, but he actually had two life insurance policies, which is even more strange. I can't tell you what his motivator factor is, but one thing that he did do is he was diagnosed terminal cancer. So he's basically spent one whole life insurance policy while he was still around. And I think, great, you know, live your life, do all the things he wanted to do. And he did that. I can't answer your question directly because I just didn't get that answer from him. But, you know, I'm grateful that there was something there in the end. Yeah.
It's amazing to me as well, Dave, that a lot of young people, and I think we can still call ourselves young in our 30s.
Yeah, luckily in my 30s.
Oh, yeah, 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 not for too long. Oh, I know, it does get you. But a lot of younger people think not just about their kids, but also about their grandkids and wanting to create this generational wealth. Now, it's somewhat of a cliche, but I always like the saying, if you don't come from a wealthy family, then a wealthy family must come from you. And it's just fascinating that you're thinking so much about your kids and grandkids. How do you want their life to be different because you've invested in property?
I wanted to create a situation where I was trying to grow what I was left with, but also I thought property would be a good way to go because at a worst case scenario, no matter what he's doing, I could always kick him out of home and put him in there. Or if he went out in the world and he needed a place or he just wanted to say buy into something or even just rent a place, he could always have that. I could charge him the base level, put him in there. He could throw some mates in as roomies. And it was just options, really. It was more thinking on the practical side of options. And now that I'm a little bit further along, it's now about, well, we are actually in this game now. I do have a portfolio, although I never really look at it like that. And yeah, how do I educate him towards looking after that when I'm not around? So at the moment, we actually had a few big talks because I'm rehashing my will and doing a contracting out agreement at the moment. And
good.
And I have to bring him into these sorts of things because basically when my dad passed, he left me alone to figure everything out. But I want him to be able to hit the ground running.
And you say you don't really think of yourself as a portfolio investor. You're in the top 2 or 1%, is it? If you own 3 rental properties, top 1% of property investors. So you've done really well. Can you tell us about the properties that you've actually purchased?
So I had the first rental and I had a little bit of money sitting left in the bank. And I talked to a good friend of mine, shout out to Russell from ASB, banking manager. Had a chat to him and he basically said, look, what do you want to do is invest in something like this, and showed me a commercial residential type property. And he said, you could, you know, sell your house, live upstairs and operate your business out downstairs. And I thought that's great. Just the timing of it wasn't right because it was going to cost a little bit more for commercial. It was going to take a little bit longer to build. And then I started looking at turnkey duplexes. Now I'm actually an electrician. So I was like, well, hey, let's talk with some people in the game. Reached out to a few developers and found one that was building one next to a mate of mine. So it's just all networking. Basically talked to him and said, look, what do you got going? And he said, come look at these properties. And so I started looking at them and did some numbers with a broker and basically got to a point where I was like, actually, I'm not for the cost of it. They were $719 at the time. And I said to the broker, I was like, I reckon if I stretch, what's the chances I could buy two? But my only condition was I wanted them side by side and I wanted them local because I had this thing in my head, like I could help with the maintenance being fairly handy and all that sort of stuff. But I wanted them side by side because I didn't want to have like one here and one there. And next minute I'm having some sort of dispute with the owner of the other one that's attached to mine, you know? So that's how I found them. And then basically just went through the game of trying to clear that with the bank. And that was another big battle because self-employed once again, at that point I didn't have a second partner, but I had a fairly good sized deposit. And my broker went back to the bank multiple times. I just kept changing some parameters and meeting criteria. And then we ended up getting over the line. We actually got it over the line, but I was short by about 60K, which ended up being a bit of a firestorm at the end because when it came time for settlement, I'd totally forgotten about this extra money that I need to drum up.
60 grand is a lot of extra money to drum up. How did you do it?
It is basically family is things that were left behind by my father and, yeah, and amongst the family that I was able to find that as a stopgap.
And it was a stressful couple of weeks while you wrestled to get the 60 grand. You don't look down the back of the sofa for that.
Yep, more than a couple of weeks.
Well, it's amazing. When it comes to banks, it doesn't matter how many no's you get to a point. I mean, it can affect your credit score, but most of the time, it doesn't matter how many no's you get as long as you get a yes, because you only need to get the loan one time.
Sounds like how many times you had to ask our Angela.
Oh, no, I only took negative one times. Oh, no. I don't even know what that means myself.
So you do raise a good point, though, and I've had plenty of friends that have, like, applied for loans and things, and then they get told no for whatever reason, and that just becomes so disheartening for them. They get put off the whole process, and my whole thing is, no, just change your perimeter, increase something, decrease something, change something, go back and ask again, and when they say no, ask again, and then again, until you make it work. But things are pretty hard at the moment, I will admit.
Talk to us about that.
I'm not personally looking to do anything more yet because I'm, as far as I'm concerned, I'm absolutely tapped out. I'm probably more tapped out than I should be. But eventually I will look to probably get rid of the older property and get something newer, both for the maintenance and for interest deductibility and things like that. All things that I've learned since listening to your show, but I definitely won't be able to do anything now. I'm sort of just surviving.
And actually, because you shared some of the numbers with us, those two duplexes that you purchased, you bought them right at the peak of the market when lots of people were investing, myself included, Ed included, where prices were high, interest rates were really low. Now you've settled them. From what I read, your values are lower than the purchase price and the interest rates are way higher than what you're budgeting for. How are you managing that both from a cash flow standpoint, but also from a mental standpoint?
So the mental standpoint is definitely the most important to me because if my head's not in the game, especially being self-employed, you know, you carry so much stress around with you at any given point in time. The short answer is I don't know the numbers offhand, but I am having to top up quite significantly. I actually took a loan from my trust to start up my business right at the beginning. So that meant that when I had a talk with my accountant, I was able to filter money from a business back into the trust to help cover the top-ups that I need to because they're quite significant. Like my mortgage is massive. And going back to the mental standpoint, where I really came undone was I came into this game, like I say, thinking that this money isn't mine. I need to do something more with it. And then my backup was always in my head. And I kept saying to people around me, oh, you know, but if it all goes tits up, I'll just sell them and, you know, be flush again, you know, back to square. And then all of a sudden, it's like the value is less than what I bought it for, and my interest rates are high. And that's not something I'd even conceived of back then. Back then being only like a year or two ago.
The old days.
And even when I sat down with the accountant and we were like trying to stress test things, and she goes, well, you know, if interest rates got as high as 6%, and now that's like, oh, bring us back down to 6,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, the mental side is definitely more of a bigger thing because I don't take anything for granted, but I do think, hey, it's only money. And if things did go absolutely horrible, I'll probably have to sell everything and still have a mortgage to pay. But so long as I'm okay in my mental state, then I know that my household's okay and my partner and our kids and things like that are okay. That's the main thing for me.
So how do you deal with that from a mental standpoint?
Compartmentality. I just put it away in little boxes, section by section. It is literally just focusing on one thing at a time. My partner says I have many tabs open. I think that's the best way to describe me. And I just try to focus on one thing at a time. So the biggest thing for now is, you know, the repayments and the state of the interest. And I know that I can't stay in the same position that I am all the time. I can't just keep repaying because I don't have, money's not coming out of nowhere. So we need to change things. So one thing going forward, this is my current partner who I've been with for just over a year. And very serious with. So I've said to her, well, look, I've got this, my first property. I've got a smaller part of my mortgages is against that. And she ended up with a bit of money herself. And so we've agreed to both put into that property. And that's my way of both bringing her into the investment game, giving her something that will grow in capital growth. She's doing her own due diligence. And that's why we're doing the contract down agreement, all that sort of stuff at the moment. But it also means that it reduces my mortgage on that, which means my repayments are less over there, and we'll have some passive income for both of us, which is, in my case, well, from my perspective, win-win, and just try to lay everything out for her and let her do her own due diligence and, yeah, hopefully work out good for both of us.
I really like your attitude towards tackling big problems little by little. And I think that often we can look at the market right now and say, it's really hard. I was talking to an investor just at the weekend and, you know, their mortgage is more than what the value of the property is right now. The interest rates are killing them. They're topping up as much as the tenant is topping up. And a lot of that stuff you can't control as an investor. But there's stuff that you can control and you work on, and it does seem quite painful right now, but you've got to look to the longer horizon and then chip away at the things you can control, your income, your structures, all of those kind of things. And it doesn't have a major impact right now, but over the long term and holding on to a property through the long term, that has a major impact. And if you can just get through, you know, the next couple of years, life will get a lot better.
I definitely think that if you don't tackle the little problems one at a time, then things tend to, you know, roll into the next thing. And especially me running my own business, that carries a lot of stress and its own stuff with it. I mean, what ends up happening at the end of the day is, say, my son doesn't do the dishes after school, and then I come home and I might explode at him. And, you know, that's not anything to do with anything else other than I'm just carrying one thing into the next. And if you don't compartmentalize, then everything just starts getting a bit muddy.
And Dave, one thing that I sometimes get from listeners of the show, and it's quite fascinating, really. People sometimes think that property investment doesn't align with their values, or they think that property investment isn't a morally right thing to do. So how does property investment sit with your values?
Well, I think I might get a bit of bad feedback for this, but I look at everything in life as a bit of a game. And to be honest, I think that as much as people might hate, say, capitalism or the money game and that sort of thing, we all live in it. And if you're not playing, then you're going to end up somewhere at the back. That's kind of how I look at it. And I've got friends that are totally like landlords are the scum of the earth, and they're doing this and that. But then I also listen to things like you're saying, where landlords are providing housing for in situations where people might not otherwise be able to get that housing for themselves. And also, especially when you're buying like new builds and things like this, or making renovations to older homes, bringing up to healthy home standards. Now, I view all of these things as a good thing. You know, a friend of mine who might be renting a house that's got no carpet, it's got drainage problems, it's got no insulation and all these sorts of things. Now they have a claim to say, hey, the landlord's got this sort of thing going on. I've also listened to landlords in meetings, especially when Healthy Home Standards was first coming out, complain that they've lived in a house for 30 years and now that they have to rent it, the tenants are getting a better house than they're in. And I was actually at one meeting, which is at Ray White was hosting this, and I stopped the person that said that exact thing. And I said, hang on, you need to understand first and foremost that this is a business. You run a business and your business is accommodation, and you wouldn't go to a motel and expect to be living in the same standards of what, you know, your house was. So I have a pretty positive view on it all, but I'm also not naive to the fact that there are a lot of people out there that do take advantage. There are a lot of tenants that take advantage of landlords, and there's a lot of landlords that take advantage of people. And there's also a lot of people that are only in it to gain money, and that's not quite, I want to create something that's good for my, you know, children and grandkids. It's not about creating just money for the sake of it.
Fantastic. Let's wrap it up there. But please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. Really does help us get the message out to more people. And hey, I want to hear your stories on the podcast as well. So if you're like Dave, you're investing in property, you don't have to own 3 properties. Maybe you've only got 1. Maybe you're just starting out on your journey, or maybe you got 50. I want to hear your stories, because this is about building a property investment community that we're all part of. So send me an email, edit@opuspartners.co.nz. I'd love to have you on the show. Thanks for listening to the Property Academy podcast. I'm your host, Steve McKnight.
And I'm Andrew Nicholl.
We're going to be back again tomorrow with even more daily strategies, tactics, and insights to help you get the most out of the New Zealand property market. Until next time.